Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. So glad that you joined us on the broadcast today. Well, if you've been watching the news for the last couple of days, you know that a couple of things have taken place. One, the President of the United States spoke from the Oval Office the other day in order to address the situation that's taking place, specifically with the latest terror attacks that took place in San Bernardino, California. And the president's stated goal, was to come on the air to assure the American people that his strategy to go after ISIS and contain ISIS was well underway, and the American people could have a lot of confidence in that strategy and be assured that their safety was being looked after by the president and those elected officials that have that as their responsibility. Well, that particular speech received a lot of backlash. A lot of commentary was written about it, specifically about the apologetic aspect of it, where the president spent a long portion of that speech actually talking about how there shouldn't be any sort of backlash against Muslims and so forth. And that portion of the speech, as I mentioned, really caught a number of people's attention, and they spoke about why the president feels the need, after each one of these attacks, to come out and basically be some sort of an apologist for Islam. Well, shortly thereafter, after that speech, Donald Trump made an announcement right here in the state of South Carolina, and he was speaking, I think, at the coast in Charleston. And during his speech, Donald Trump announced that he was calling for, basically, a moratorium on Muslims entering the United States. There's an article in WMD. It says this. It's, the title of it says Trump, and then it says, ban all Muslims entry into the U.S. for now. And then the subtitle of it, this was published just 18 hours ago on WND.com. The subtitle says this. There's a great a quote from Trump. He says, there is a great hatred towards Americans by large segments of this population. The article goes on to say this then. It says, GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump several times has stunned the political pundits with his outspoken comments of what he'd do with immigration. And then they go on to talk about what he said at the beginning of his campaign concerning the idea of closing the borders and stopping the flood of illegal immigrants that were pouring over our southern border. But later on in the article, it goes and says this. It says, just a day after President Obama took to the nationwide television to warn people not to be prejudiced against Muslims, Trump called out Obama over the two Muslims, a husband and a wife, who attacked a Christmas party in San Bernardino, California last week, killing 14 and injuring another 21. He tweeted, just put out a very important policy statement on extraordinary influx of hatred and danger coming into our country. We must be vigilant, unquote, in his article. So he calls for a moratorium then, complete stopping, at least for now, of allowing Muslims to immigrate into the United States. Well, of course, this was met by an outcry from the modern media today, the mainstream media, and not only them, but other GOP candidates such as Jeb Bush. He said that Trump is unhinged. Ted Cruz, who I heard speak just yesterday morning here in Greenville, attended a dinner last night with Ted Cruz speaking to a number of pastors here in Greenville. He said that's not my policy. Chris Christie said it was ridiculous. And Lindsey Graham, as if anybody cared, but Lindsey Graham said, I condemn this statement. And so it took very little time for a number of people to distance themselves from the comments that were made. Of course, in the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton called the idea reprehensible. Bernie Sanders said that it is demagoguery taking place and so forth. Well, I wanted to talk about that. Is it really such an outlandish statement? You know, I've called for a moratorium on this program of building any more mosques in the United States. I've said that, you know, the number of these events that take place, these people were influenced by what was said at the mosque. The mosques seem to be complicit in what is taking place in some of these cases. And so I just said we need to get a handle on this. We need to understand what's going on. Well, I want to take a look at this idea. Should we, as believers, there's been some believers and evangelical leaders that have come out against Donald Trump's statement as well and said that this is wrong and this is not what we're about. And if we, I think it was Russell Moore who made the analogy that if we allow them to come and stop the Muslims and building of mosques, what's to stop them from coming against the Christians, the government from coming against the Christian, and coming into our prayer meetings and our Bible studies and stopping that from taking place? Well, I disagree. I think what the difference is that we don't have a group of people leaving those Bible studies and then going out and killing 14 people and injuring 21 others. We don't have a group of people going out and doing these horrific acts that are coming out of those. There's the difference between the two. So it's not apples to apples. And so I think that comparison is lacking in many, many ways. But I want to talk about this. And who better to talk about this with than Bill Federer? William Federer is the lead person out on AmericanMinute.com. That's where you can read all about Bill and about the different books that he has authored and so forth. Let me just read a little bit about Bill's background. It says that William J. Federer is a nationally known speaker, a best-selling author, and the president of Amerisearch Incorporated, a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. Bill's American Minute radio feature is broadcast daily across America, and by Internet, his Faith and History Television airs on TCT Network on stations across America and via DirecTV. He's a former U.S. Congressional candidate. He's appeared on C-SPAN, Fox, Hannity and Combs, you name it. It goes on and on and on, a number of different radio television programs. He's been interviewed on thousands of radio programs, including Focus on the Family, Janet Parshall's America, Point of View, and so forth, Phyllis Schlafly, and many, many, many other radio programs as well. He's got a number of books that have been produced as well, talking about America, and in particular, today we're talking about the issue related to Islam. He's got some latest books on that particular topic as well that we're going to talk about during the program today. Bill is actually with me in the studio. He was over there, spoke yesterday at the event that we were at, and he was so gracious to allow me to whisk him over away from the event as it ended here this morning, race him over to the studio. I'm sure he felt very near to God as I was racing down the 385 with him to get over here in time. But he graciously came over to talk with us for a few moments in the studio. Bill, welcome to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
It's great to be with you.
Bill, when I say that it's not an apples-to-apples comparison, let's talk a little bit about the history of Islam. You and I were discussing it a little bit, so feel free to reiterate a couple of those points we talked about at your table. But tell our listening audience a little bit about what has taken place with Islam and why this comment by Donald Trump is not so outrageous after all, that there's certain things we should take into consideration when we think about Muslims immigrating into America.
Well, when we see that there are Muslims that kill people and our politicians tell us, well, they don't represent true Islam. Yet the Muslims that are doing the killing are yelling, Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater, and they claim that they are following true Islam. Mm. Who can tell us what true Islam is? Muhammad. Muhammad was the best Muslim that ever lived. And so his life is the example. In Arabic, that's called Sunnah. And so if we examine Muhammad's life, we can get an insight into those that are trying to follow his example.
Mm-hmm.
And so Muhammad's life went through three stages. First, he was a religious leader in the pagan city of Mecca, and he only made 70 converts in 12 years. And he begins to get confrontational. And the people of Mecca consider him a disturber of the peace. And they want to get rid of him, but they can't because he has a rich uncle named Abu Talib, who was the most powerful merchant in the town. Well, Abu Talib dies in 619 AD, and Muhammad's wife Khadija dies. She was 40 years old. He was 25. He goes on to have 11 to 22 wives, slave wives, concubines, but this was the first wife. She dies in 619 AD. So 619 is his year of sorrows, and the people of Mecca decide, let's get rid of Muhammad. And so they eventually chase him out in 622 AD. He tries to go to a city called Al-Ta'if, and they pelt him with stones and rocks and throw dust on him, and the little kids jeer and mock Muhammad out of town. And so Muhammad has no place to go. He is a Muslim refugee. And so there's a Jewish city to the north called Medina. And three Jewish tribes control the city, and they're nice. They let Muhammad in as a Muslim immigrant. And Muhammad goes into the minority neighborhoods, and he begins to organize a following. We're familiar with the term of organizing in the community, and he gets a following, and then he goes back to the Jews and pressures them to accommodate him and his followers politically. Change your laws to accommodate us, and then he becomes a political leader. So Muhammad transitions from being a religious leader to also being a political leader. And then something happens. Muhammad's followers in Mecca, they get pushy, argumentative, confrontational, and threatening. They get chased out of town for disturbing the peace. They have no place to go. They are Muslim refugees. They go to Medina, and the Jews are nice. They let them in as Muslim immigrants. They go to the neighborhood where Muhammad's at, and Muhammad allows his followers to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans chasing him out of town. And so where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, his attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate, take their caravan. So he gets a whole chapter of the Quran from his Allah that is chapter 8, Surah 8, on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. He gets a fifth of the booty. And so the Meccans are hurting economically, and they send 1,000 soldiers to protect and escort their caravan. Muhammad, with 300 warriors, defeats 1,000 at the Battle of Badra in 624 AD. This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad that his Allah wants him to be a military leader. And so he transitions from being a religious leader to a political leader to a military leader, and he fights in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. He even goes back to that city of Al-Ta'if, and he uses catapults to hurl rocks into the town. And when his men tell him that these rocks are killing innocent women and children, Muhammad's response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers and ISIS killers and San Bernardino killers say it's okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And since Muhammad is the best Muslim, he's the perfect Muslim. Muslims that want to be better Muslims, they want to be like Muhammad religiously, politically, and militarily. So there's freedom for all religions in America. But Islam is not just a religion because Muhammad was not just a religious leader. He was a political and a military leader. So our effort in the split the religious side of Islam away from the political military side is we're trying to split Muhammad. Who are we to split their prophet? He was all three, a religious leader, a political leader, and a military leader. Now, in the year 627 AD, the Meccans are hurting because of their caravans being attacked. So they decide to send a coalition force of 10,000 of their pagan warriors to Medina to stop Muhammad and his men from robbing the caravans. turns out Muhammad is a brilliant military leader, primarily because he's creative. He's unpredictable. He's unconventional. In other words, he doesn't play by the rules of traditional Arab warfare. These Arabs had 1 month off a year where they agreed not to fight, gentlemen's agreement, and they would go on pilgrimage to Mecca and worship the Kaaba. They had this square building that housed 360 different pagan gods, and it was a peaceful thing. But Muhammad gets verses from his Allah to attack the caravans during this Ramadan pilgrimage month, catches them totally by surprise, and he comes away with a lot of booty. And so the people of Mecca send this coalition force, these 10,000 soldiers, to Medina. And Muhammad's version of roadside bombs and IEDs was he dug potholes and trenches all around the city, which rendered the superior cavalry of the Meccans useless. You can't charge your horses and camels across a field full of potholes and trenches while you're being shot at from the walls. They'll break their legs, right? Mm-hmm. And so it throws off the battle strategy. So Muhammad goes to some of the tribes, the pagan tribes, at night, and he bribes them, and they slip away. He goes to some of the other pagan tribes at night, and he threatens them, and they slip away. Sort of the Chicago politics, the bribe or the bullet, you know, the silver or the lead. And then it gets freezing cold for a week, and the rest of the Meccans lose heart and decide to bring their troops home. And they leave a power vacuum, similar to last year when our president decided the war in Iraq and Afghanistan was over, mission complete, and he brought all of our troops home and it left a power vacuum. Question, did they all become really peaceful after that? No. Well, in Muhammad's case, when the Meccans retreated, he was emboldened that his enemies were cowards and unable to subdue him. So he goes back into that Jewish city of Medina, and he gets offended at one of the Jewish tribes, whips his followers into a jihad frenzy. They attack that tribe, confiscate all of that tribe's property, and chase them out of town. And he's smart enough politically to pick on the smallest of the tribe that the other two didn't like. And they sort of said, well, we'll keep our heads low. Maybe he won't notice us, and you know, at least he's not picking on us. But now there's two Jewish tribes left. The second Jewish tribe does something that offends Muhammad. He whips his followers into a frenzy. They attack and confiscate that tribe's property and chase them out of town. This actually set a precedent in Islam called Hudna, H-U-D-N-A, Hudna. It means when you're weak, you make treaties until you get strong enough to disregard them. So when he first came to Medina, he was weak. He was a refugee. He was organizing the community, got followers, and he pressures the Jews to make a treaty. But he has this treaty. But now it's 5 years later, and he just drove away the Meccans, the only ones who could come to the Jews' rescue. He's in a position of strength, so he finds these excuses to get offended and break the treaties. And so here we are pressuring Israel to make a treaty with the Palestinians when the Muslim concept of a treaty is just a ceasefire to restock missiles. Here we are wanting to do a treaty with Iran when their concept of treaty is just to put your enemy off so you can finish building your nuclear reactors. Anyway, the third Jewish tribe in Medina. Muhammad bottles them in their neighborhood for 25 days. He's taking a bath, is what the Hadith says. Excuse me. And a spirit appeared to him and says, how can you rest when Allah's enemies are in your midst? He said, where? And the spirit pointed toward the Jewish neighborhood. So Muhammad gets his warriors to surround this neighborhood for 25 days. And when the Jews finally surrender, Muhammad brings them into the market and chops off their heads, 600 or 700 of them, and then sells the women and children into slavery. He did keep one of the wives for himself, Rehana, but he went on to have anywhere from 11 to 22 wives, slave wives, concubines. But within 5 years of Muhammad coming into the Jewish city of Medina, there is not a Jew left in the city of Medina. They were chased out, killed, or enslaved. And so we see it's a three-step process, very similar to Caesar's three steps, Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered, right? Mm-hmm. His was immigrate, increase, eliminate. So he immigrated to this Jewish town as a religious refugee. He was being persecuted, had no place to go. And then he increases his followers amongst the victimized minorities and then demands political accommodation. And then he eliminates the previous culture and gets militaristic. And so this is the plan that the Muslim Brotherhood has. Infiltrate countries as religious Muslims, then build a community, and then begin to demand that you have political accommodations, don't offend us, and, you know, take bacon out of the prisons, and, you know, don't show pictures of a killer without the burqa on. I mean, you know, and then they get militant. Now, I speak around the country. I wrote a book called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. I was speaking in Detroit. Afterwards, I'm visiting with people at the book table, and there's a lady who had a ministry to pregnant moms. And she had gone by a Muslim house with a little present for the pregnant Muslim mom. While she's there, out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom. Out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom. Out of a bedroom comes another pregnant Muslim mom, all pregnant by the same man. He's practicing Sharia law in his house in Dearborn, Michigan. And so then another guy at my book table says, Fazel bought a bunch of houses on the street, has a wife in each one. They go down to the welfare office and say, my husband's not around, and they get these checks. He visits them, and the more kids they have, the larger the checks get. And he's living like a king at state expense, and all the kids playing in the middle of the street are his children. He is practicing Sharia law on his block. Then they take over several more blocks, and they vote in the school board. And now they have the girls with their burqas and their Sharia in the public schools in Dearborn, Michigan. Then they vote in the city council, like in Hamtramck, Michigan, a majority Muslim city council. They vote in the police department, fire department. And then they have their minarets and their calls to prayer 5 times a day on loudspeakers, no different than Pakistan. And all the Polish and previous inhabitants of that community are driven out. And so we see it's a pattern. Now, There are always those that refuse to move out and say, this is my neighborhood, I grew up here. And that's when Muslim youth do random violence and there's no witnesses. Because no Muslim family will testify against another Muslim family on behalf of some kafir infidel.
Mm-hmm.
If they do, they'll get targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that it's this pattern of coming in, taking advantage of the diversity and freedom of, you know, multiculturalism and so forth, and then you build a community, and then they're gravitating and building community, and in comes an imam, says, okay, now that we're here, we need to start following the Quran closer. Ladies start wearing the burqas and so forth. And the burqas have the same psychological effect on non-Muslim neighbors as gang colors. I actually spoke, and there's a in Oklahoma City, and afterwards a SWAT team officer said, you just described the gangs I deal with. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you join a gang, but if you leave the gang, they kill you. And you join Islam, but if you leave Islam, it's called the Ridda laws, the apostasy laws, they'd kill you. I talked to a former Muslim, Elijah Abraham. He was an Iraqi Muslim who, long story, ended up coming to America and became a Christian. He said, if they would remove the Ridda laws, the apostasy laws, 90% of Muslims would leave overnight. He says they're in it because there's this fear that you'll get killed. In communism, you might have a neighbor kill you. In Islam, your own family member might kill you.
Honor killings.
And so it's this fear that keeps them in. Anyway, but it's a three-step process of immigrating, increasing, eliminating. And so Muhammad and the rightly guided caliphs are at the core of Islam. And so Muhammad dies in 632 AD. Within 100 years of his death, the Muslims conquer Christian Egypt. People forget Egypt had been Christian for 6 centuries, evangelized by Mark, that wrote the Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, until the Muslim leader Amir ibn Alas invades around 642 AD. Jerusalem had been a Byzantine Christian city for 3 centuries, until Caliph Umar conquered it around 638. And then Syria was the first country to completely be Christian, evangelized by the Apostle Paul, and Antioch, Syria, is where the name Christian was first used, until Caliph Umar conquered it. People forget there's more ancient Christian writing in the Syrian language of Syriac than any other language other than Greek and Latin. And these Syrian Christians evangelized east like the Greeks did west. So they evangelized into India, Mongolia, Persia, even China during the Tang Dynasty in the 600s had a thriving Syrian Christian community that lasted all the way through the Yuan Dynasty with Kublai Khan. You remember Marco Polo went over there? But then the Ming drove him out, and then there was a Muslim leader named Tamerlane. Killed 17 million people from Korea to Hungary, and he wipes out Christianity in Central Asia. But then the Muslims conquer North Africa. People forget North Africa used to be Christian, right? It was all part of the Roman Empire, Greco-Roman, and then when the Roman Empire became Christian, it all became Christian. So Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, Libya, there were 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa in the 7th century. St. Augustine of Hippo was from Carthage, that's, you know, Tunisia today. And so the Christians of North Africa had embraced their version of separation of church and state. It was this hyper-pietism that said if you really become a Christian, you should give away your money and live in a cave. If you really become a Christian, you should give away your money, live in a monastery, or build a platform in the desert, climb on top, bake in the sun, thinking you're getting your, you know, holier because you're denying your flesh. But it was this abandonment to try to preserving your community. And so as a result, Islam just swept through North Africa in 10 years, the Umayyad Muslims. And then in the year 711, there were warring Visigothic Christian kingdoms in Spain. One of them gets the bright idea to go across the Strait of Gibraltar, gather the Muslim hordes to help their side. 80,000 Muslims cross the Strait of Gibraltar in 711 A.D., and in 10 years they conquer all of Spain. Because the Spaniards are still fighting on foot with heavy metal swords, Muslims have their scimitar swords, their stirrups, their Arabian horses, and they conquer. They carry away tens of thousands into slavery. There were entire Catholic orders that started in Europe called the Trinitarians. The head of the order was called the Ransomer, and they would collect alms and donations and go to the across, you know, the Mediterranean to the North Africa, try to ransom your friend back that got captured by the Muslims. In 846 AD, 11,000 Muslims invaded Rome, Italy, and they trashed the Basilica of St. Peter's and trashed the bones of St. Peter and St. Paul. It was after that that Pope Leo decided to build the wall around the Vatican. Anyway, Muslims cross the Pyrenees Mountains. They're conquering southern France. You read the story of the Battle of Bordeaux. In one pass, the Muslim cavalry annihilates the Frankish army. So the Franks, where we get the word French, the Franks are standing in a field. The Muslims are charging, and they're on their horses that have armor. They are wearing armor. They have their scimitar swords. The Franks are on foot with these heavy metal swords. In one pass, the Muslim cavalry annihilates the Frankish army. And so they're unstoppable in setting up their ISIS, their Islamic State, their caliphate, right? And the caliph is the supreme leader after Muhammad died, and the caliphate is what he controls. So Pope Gregory puts out a plea that anybody that could fight should join Charles Martel. He was the grandfather of Charlemagne. Charles Martel gets 30,000 volunteers in Tours, France, outside of Paris. And he doesn't like the idea of standing in a field waiting to get sliced up, so he puts his men on top of a hill. And it's 30,000 guys packed together. They're all on foot. And the Muslim commander, Abdurrahman, is charging up the hill with his men. And from their vantage point, it looks like a line. And they're used to just charging through the line, coming out the other side. Well, they charge in and get stuck because it's 30,000 guys packed together in one square. Meanwhile, Charles Martel had arranged for some of his men to sneak into the Muslim camp and free the captives. You see, they fought for religion, but they also fought for plunder. Muhammad said you can have four wives plus as many other women as your right hand possesses. And so, of course, the Sultan got a fifth. Many sultans had 1,000 wives. And, of course, if you die, you get 72 virgins in paradise. So there's a sexual motivation to die in your fight to spread Islam.
Mm-hmm. I want to stop you right there just for a second, Bill. Hold that thought just for a second. We've got to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, here we are. You just set up the battle's about to take place here. They've gone behind enemy lines and freed the captives. I want to pick it up right there when we come back from the break. Let me tell our listening audience that we're talking with Bill Federer. You can learn more. You're getting a history lesson here this afternoon on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. But you can find out more about Bill, about the book that he referenced and other books that he's written as well, out on his website, which is theamericanminute.com. Americanminute.com. You can go out there to find out more about Bill and everything that Bill was involved in. Stay tuned. We're going to come right back. He'll let Bill pick it right back up where we left off. You can see how many analogies this has and applications to where we're at today in America.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
Hi, this is Corey Truax, inviting you to listen to the next creatively titled Corey Truax Show right here on Christian Talk 660. It is insightful commentary on culture, politics, and the church, and we have a lot of fun and laughs along the way. It is a decision you will not regret. Join me for the next Corey Truax Show.
The Corey Truax Show, Saturday mornings at 8 on Christian Talk 660 and 92.9. Did you know there are more cell phones in the United States than our entire population? That means chances are you have a cell phone. But what do you do when it doesn't work properly? Maybe the face is cracked, or the camera stopped working, or the speakers don't sound right, or it won't charge. Well, you can fight your way through traffic to a repair shop and sit there for an hour or more while they fix it, or you can call a trusted expert to come to you. Chris Larson is a certified tech with Mobile Cell Repairs, and he'll come to your location and fix your cell phone in less than an hour at a price you can afford. Go to mobilecellrepairs.com and check him out, or call Chris now for an appointment at 864-420-4563. Have your device repaired where you are, when you want. And remember, quality is always the top priority. Mobile Cell Repairs.
Al and Lisa Robertson, stars of A&E's Duck Dynasty, are proudly pro-life. I'm Lisa Van Riper with SC Citizens for Life, inviting you to hear their life-affirming testimony for the unborn and medically fragile at the Rally for Life on Saturday, January 9th at noon at the State House in Columbia. Join Al and Lisa Robertson and speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. Call 803-252-LIFE.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Okay, welcome back into the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. We've been speaking with William Federer, and William Federer, of course, is the president of Amerisearch. He's also the name of the website to get to it. Let me give you that. It may be a little bit easier, but it's AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute. That's all one word, .com. And you can go out there to learn more about Bill himself as an author and a speaker. He does come to speak to churches about the subject that we're talking about today, many other subjects as well, and I think he does so on a love offering basis. So if you're interested in having Bill come to your church or your event in order to talk about these things, that's available for him to do that. www.AmericanMinute.com. The book in particular that we've been zeroing in on is the thoughts about the title of it. Let me give you that. It says, What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. And what every American needs to know about the Quran. And it's a history of Islam and the United States. And this is vitally important. We tied it to a news story right in the very beginning where Donald Trump has called for a moratorium on Muslims entering the United States. It's thrown a number of other politicians into a tizzy. The media is beside themselves on how outrageous this is and so forth. But the question is, is it really? When we consider, you know, all of the historical context of Islam, when we see what is taking place, the website, The Religion of Peace, keeps a running total of the number of terrorist events or attacks that have taken place since 9/11. That number is now, I think, over 25,000, closer to 30,000 attacks that have taken place since 2011. 9/11 on 2001, and over 20 to 30,000 attacks. Where the person who did the killing during the attack said that they were doing it because of what they were ordered to do by reading the Quran. This is not somebody just, you know, beside themselves and so forth. They're pointing back to the teaching of the Quran. So Islam is unique. We don't have this with people that claim to be Buddhists. We don't have this with people that are in other religions. Islam is unique. That's the issue. And so since they're unique, it's both political, it is religious, it's got a military element to it. We need to take all of these facts into consideration before we just open the floodgate of the American immigration system and just say, come on in. Because you're a religion, we can't say anything about what you believe. Just come on in among us here and have your way. Well, I think that we need to stop and look and very carefully assess what's taking place. Bill's been taking us through a history of Muhammad himself. How do we know what Islam is, what it believes? Well, let's go to the founder of Islam, Muhammad himself. And Bill has been talking about what he did. And we left off right where we're talking about, I think, the beginning of the Crusades is where he's getting to. He's telling us about a battle that is going to take place, an attempt to try to stop the Muslims from going in and taking over these the ISIS of that day of taking over all of these different countries and regions. And so I think we're right about at the beginning of the Crusade. Bill, pick up, if you would, where you left off just before we had to take a break.
Well, this is actually four centuries before the Crusades.
Okay.
So this is the Muslim Crusade.
Okay.
Right? So the Muslim Crusaders had 14 centuries of conquering Christian, Jewish, and Hindu in other areas of the world, these Muslim Crusaders. And the way the Muslim fighters would work is they would ride into town suddenly with their Arabian horses, their stirrups, and their scimitar swords, and they would commit terror. They would randomly kill people. Mm-hmm. And the town would freak out. And they'd say, what do we have to do to stop you? And they'd say, submit. If you submit, then we'll stop. And they say, okay, we submit. What do we do now? Men, get your swords and your horses and follow us to the next town.
Mm-hmm.
And the next town, and the next town, and the next town. And they would say that if you joined into jihad, if you're a slave, you're free. You don't have to pay your bills anymore. If you you get women, right, four wives, plus as many extra women as your right hand possesses. They just don't have the status of a wife, slave wives, concubines. And then if you die, you get 72 women. And if you decide you don't want to join, they kill you. And they take your wives and daughters and divide them up amongst themselves. And so it harnessed this unusual mixture of human motivations where it has a lust element together with a religious fervor element.
Hmm.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
You know? And so they conquer all these Christian areas. They conquer into India. And so they kill tens of millions of Hindus. These Hindus had 360 different gods, and the Muslims come in, oh, you're just a new god. You know, fine, we'll let you have your little temple. They could not conceive of the concept of a religion that is exclusive, saying it's only ours. They're like, but what about all these? And so because of their inability to identify the nature of the exclusivity of Islam, they suffered all of northern India being conquered, and again, tens of millions. Tamerlane, the Muslim leader, left pyramids of skulls. He raided Delhi, India, and tell his men to come back with a skull in every hand. He goes to his advisors, where are the infidels that I could kill them so I can be a Ghazi warrior? You know, Benghazi? Well, Ghazi is the word for Muslim warrior. And anyway, so they invade into Spain. They conquer Spain in 10 years. They conquer southern France, and they're finally stopped at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD by Charles Martel, the grandfather of Charlemagne. And Charles Martel gets his 30,000 volunteers on top of a hill. Muslims attack, and they get stuck because they're charging into this group. And then they begin to let the women go. Charles Martel had spies going into the camp freeing the captives. And so the Muslims... Commander Abdul Rahman is yelling at his men, telling them to get back to the fight. And he gets distracted and he gets killed. And now the Muslim warriors can't decide who their next commander is going to be. They start bickering amongst themselves. And they decide they're going to pick up with their booty, their women captives, and they're going to go back to Spain. That was the Battle of Tours in 732 AD, exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. They go from Arabia to Paris in 100 years. It's a military campaign. And had Charles Martel not stopped them at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD, you and I would be speaking Arabic right now. Because German, French, English, and Spanish would have never developed as languages. We'd be like Egypt, where the Muslims cut out the tongues of anybody caught speaking the Coptic language. Coptic is the Egyptian word for Egyptian. And so they eradicated an entire national language because they said Arabic is the divine language because that's the language Muhammad got the Quran in. And so... had Charles Martel not stopped them, there was no other army in Europe. They would have been unopposed all the way to Poland. And so Charles Martel learns how to make a stirrup, fight on horseback. 5 years later, his men win their first battle, and it takes 700 years of battles to drive the Muslims out of Spain. One famous leader was El Cid, Rodrigo Diaz, and Charlton Heston did a movie about El Cid, and they're driving the Muslims back, and he's courageous, and he's winning, but he's wounded, and he knows just one more charge, and he can drive the Muslims away, but he's wounded, and the guys say, look, you're bleeding to death, you're going to die, and he goes, put my body back on the horse with a board up my back, tie me on really tight, and they open the barn doors, they slap the horse, and he goes riding off in a charge. The other Spanish warriors say, well, there he goes. They hop on their horses, and they charge off, and they win the battle. After the battle, they're like, well, where's El Cid? We're all celebrating. He's over there all by himself, sort of drooped over, you know, dead. It's one of those romantic chick flicks, you know, you gotta snuggle up on the couch, you know. And so there's these battles. They finally drive the Muslims out of Spain in the year 1492. And then the Muslims captured into northern Africa, and they enslaved over 180 million Africans. Mm. People forget Muhammad was a white Arab. There are hadiths that when he would pray and lift his arms, they would see the whiteness of his armpits. Another hadith said the guy was going on early morning prayer on his donkey, rubs up against the prophet. He said, I saw the whiteness of the prophet's thigh. Another hadith said these visitors wanted to meet the prophet. He said, he's the white man reclining on the couch. And Muhammad owned African slaves. In Arabic, there's one word for African and slave. It's the same word, abd, A-B-D. It means level with the earth. Like Abdullah means slave of Allah. So every African they'd see, they call him a slave. Right? And so these Arab Muslims enslaved an estimated 180 million Africans in the next seven centuries before America was ever discovered. And they're castrating the men, selling them into, you know, all kinds of throughout the Ottoman Empire and making and selling the women into sex trafficking. A white woman got the highest amount of money at a slave market because one of Muhammad's favorite wives was a Coptic Egyptian Christian that he had captured Mary. And so they would want to capture these European women. On the Mediterranean, they had their pirate, Muslim pirate ships. They raided the coast of Italy in 846 A.D., 11,000, or they would take every woman of childbearing age. So these Italian cities would move up into the mountains, and the Muslims would take their church bells and carry them away, melt them into cannons. And so there were stretches of Italy where there was not a woman of childbearing age for generations because the Muslims. And then the Vikings became Christian, and, you know, the Normans, and they ended up coming down and capturing Sicily away from the Muslims. And so there's coasts of Italy where they said, look, you Christian Vikings, Norsemen, take over. And they let, it's called the Norman Kingdoms of Italy. You think, what are these Vikings doing ruling you? Because they were better at fighting off the Muslims than the Italians had been beaten down for so long. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so and that, so all what I just explained is the first Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. It went from the Persian Gulf to the Atlantic Ocean, and it started in 622 A.D. And then there's the Turkish Spring. This is the second spring of Islam. So the Turks, Seljuk Turks, Ottoman Turks, originated around Mongolia, and they would raid. Well, they became Muslim, and they raided into what is today Turkey. Back then it was the Byzantine Christian Empire. All seven churches mentioned in the Book of Revelation were wiped out by the Muslim Turks. Mm-hmm. And they would trash the Christian graves. And all seven churches, as I mentioned, you know, were wiped out in the Book of Revelation. Ephesus, Colossae, Galatia, these New Testament letters written churches, they were wiped out by the Muslims. The most popular Greek Orthodox saint was Saint Nicholas. Lived during Roman times, gave to the poor. I wrote a whole book on his story. But the Muslims would trash the graves of these saints. And so in the year 1087, they moved the bones of Saint Nicholas from Turkey, Greece, you know, over to Italy. And Bari, Italy, B-A-R-I. And this is the Pope builds a cathedral, names it Cathedrale Niccolo de Bari, Cathedral of Nicholas of Bari. The Pope's name is Urban II. And you may not be up on your Pope names, but this is the same Pope that went to the Council of Clermont in 1095 A.D. and begs these European leaders to send help to these Greek Christians. So Jesus said, leave the 99, go after the ones. So leave your country and take your French and English and, you know, Spanish and go over, help these Greek Christians. And they did. And it's called the Crusades. Mm. You'll say, well, weren't the Crusades terrible? The Crusades were trying to stop the Muslim Crusades. Mm. And so there's two centuries of Crusades. Richard the Lionheart led the Third Crusade. St. Louis, right? St. Louis, Missouri, where I was born. St. Louis was King Louis the Ninth of France. He led the Seventh and Eighth Crusades. The Crusades basically saved Europe because the Muslims would conquer one little kingdom, and then another little kingdom, another little kingdom. The Crusades caused the Europeans to see the bigger picture. Very similar to the 13 colonies in America, were very independent and did not get along. But then when the revolution started, they all realized we have to work together against the King of England if we're going to win this thing. And so the Crusades caused these Europeans to say, look, I may not like the French and the Spanish and the English, but I'll work together with them to stop these Muslims who are invading Europe because they want to kill us all. And anyway, so the Muslims surround Vienna. Well, they surround Constantinople and conquer it first in the year 1453. Sultan Mehmet II. And Constantinople was the capital of Europe where the Black Sea empties into the Mediterranean Sea. And when Constantinople falls to the Muslims in 1453, it ends the land trade routes to get from Europe to India and China. People forget Marco Polo went from Venice, Italy to China in the year 1271. Worked for Kublai Khan for 24 years. Marco Polo brings back to Europe spaghetti. Spaghetti noodles came from China. Mm-hmm. Brings back gunpowder came from China. Mm-hmm. Coal burning rocks. China invented their plates, China plates, porcelain. China had thread from worms, silkworms. China invented the wheelbarrow, the compass, the Pony Express. They had paper from tree pulp rather than from papyrus reeds, you know, of Egypt. And then what did they do with this paper? They made the first paper currency. You got paper currency in your wallet? That was invented in China, and it was the Yuan Dynasty. That's why they call the Chinese currency today the Yuan. And so Marco Polo was bringing back all these stories from China, and India had teas, dyes, and spices, and so the Europeans wanted to trade across the Gobi Desert, the China Silk Road, but then the Muslims conquered Central Asia, cut off the land routes, when? In 1453, when they sacked Constantinople. And so the Europeans tried to find a sea route to get to India and China, and in 1492, a guy named Columbus said, I got an idea, sail west. Runs into some islands, he thinks he's in India, so he names the people he meets the
Indians.
Think of it. We never would have called Native Americans Indians if it had not been for Islamic Jihad and Islamic State cutting off the land routes to get to India and China. So all the stories of cowboys and Indians, we never would even call them Indians if it was not for Islam cutting off the land routes to India just 40 years before Columbus set sail. And then they invade and surround Vienna, Austria in 1529. So Martin Luther starts the Reformation in 1517. In 1529, 100,000 Muslims are surrounding Vienna, Austria under Suleiman the Magnificent. Suleiman controls all of North Africa, Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, Libya, all of Egypt, all of the Holy Land, all of Persia, all of Eastern Europe, Wallachia, Moldova, Bulgaria, Hungary, but now he's surrounding Vienna. So his counterpart was the Catholic Holy Roman Emperor Charles V of Spain. And he controls all of Spain, all of Austria, all of the Spanish Netherlands, all of Italy, all the New World, and the Philippines are named after his son, King Philip of Spain. The sun never set on the Spanish Empire. So these are the two superpowers, sort of like the Cold War with the U.S. and the USSR. Back then it was the Catholic Holy Roman Empire West and the Muslim Ottoman Empire East. And Charles V is faced with this double dilemma. Muslim invasion on one hand and Protestant Reformation on the other hand. Mm-hmm. So he decides to strike a deal with the Protestants in 1555 called the Peace of Augsburg. And in this treaty is a little Latin phrase that had huge repercussions. What was the phrase? Cuius regio, eius religio, which is whose is the reign, his is the religion. In other words, look, Protestant king, believe whatever you want in your kingdom. Let's just work together against these Muslim invaders because they want to kill us all. And so that was the first treaty to recognize Protestants, and it started a domino effect in the next century where different kings decided to believe slightly different things. England became Anglican, Scotland Presbyterian, Holland Dutch Reformed, Northern Germany and Sweden were Lutheran, Switzerland Calvinist. But it was a situation, if you didn't believe the way your king did, you persecuted, you fled, and those of this mass migration are the ones that spilled over and founded colonies in America. So America probably would not have been founded had it not been for these mass migrations shifting around for conscience sake, which should not have happened if Charles V hadn't let the different kings decide, which would not have happened had he not been pressured to by this Muslim invasion.
Well, you don't hear all of this history when the president just comes out and says Islam has contributed a bunch to the world. Islam means peace. It's a religion of peace and so forth. And it's just these radicalized Islamists that we have to worry about. It sounds to me like a radicalized Islamist is one that actually believes the Quran and actually follows after Muhammad. Am I right?
Well, you're right. And in my book, I give a comparison of Jesus and Muhammad. People say, well, Muslims kill people, Christians kill people. It's all sort of a wash. Every religion has crazies that kill people. Well, that's one way of looking at it. Another way is looking at the founders. You know, if your computer acts up, what do? You reload the software the way it was when you bought it, right? You reformat the disk.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your religion acts up, what do? You go back to the way it was when it left the founders. So let's compare the founders. The largest religion in the world is Christianity, about 33%. The second largest religion in the world is Islam, about 22%. 16%, Hindu, about 8% Buddhist, and it gets on to 0.2% Jewish. Let's compare the founders of the two largest religions in the world. Jesus never killed anybody. Muhammad killed an estimated 3,000 people, including cutting off the heads of those 700 Jews in Medina. Jesus never owned slaves. Muhammad got a fifth of the slaves taken in battle. Jesus never married. Muhammad had anywhere from 11 to 22 wives, slave wives, concubines. His youngest wife, Aisha, was 6 years old. Jesus never tortured anyone. When Muhammad conquered Khaybar, the last Jewish settlement in Arabia, The chief refused to tell where the tribe's treasure was hidden. Muhammad had the chief stretched out on the ground, and they kindled a fire on his chest. He still wouldn't tell, so Muhammad had him beheaded. Jesus didn't allow his disciples to rape anyone. Duh. Muhammad did. And there's always hadiths that talk about how they did it. Jesus did not force anyone to follow him. He said something difficult. Many disciples walked with him no more. Muhammad forced him to follow him. He said, whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him. It's the riddle laws. Jesus said God was our father. In Islam, it's blasphemy to call Allah your father. Jesus forgave insults. Down on the cross saying, Father, forgive him. Muhammad avenged insults. So there's a guy named Ibn Kathal, made up poems, making fun of Muhammad, had two slave girls reciting the poems. Muhammad was insulted by the poem, so he orders Ibn Kathal murdered. So the idea of, if you insult the prophet, you get killed, goes all the way back to the prophet himself.
Hmm.
Jesus taught that we are children of God. In Islam, Allah has no children. Allah took no wife and has no son. Jesus said we're made in the image of God. In Islam, Allah has no image. And again, Jesus referred to God as our father. In Islam, it's blasphemy to call Allah your father. And so we see that in the first 3 centuries of Christianity, there were 10 major persecutions and Christians were thrown to the lions. They never led an armed resistance against the Roman emperor.
Mm-hmm.
The first 3 centuries of Islam, they conquered from Arabia to Paris. People say, well, we're all worshiping the same religion. Well, I would like that to be true, but Christianity, the largest religion, says that you believe in Jesus, that he's the Son of God, the Lamb of God that died on the cross to pay for your sins, and you go to heaven, right? Islam has an unforgivable sin called shirk, S-H-I-R-K, shirk. And they say that if you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, you have committed the unforgivable sin called shirk that condemns you to hell.
Hmm.
So the question is, if we are all worshiping the same God, how can the same God say, if you believe in Jesus, you go up, and if you believe in Jesus, you go down?
Yeah.
Either God is schizophrenic, or we're talking about two different gods. And when you give the characteristics of these gods, Jesus said the thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And we begin to see, hey, we're describing, Muhammad permitted lying. It's called taqiyya, sacred lying, holy deceit. You're obligated to lie to the infidel to help spread Islam. A story, there was a chieftain planning on attacking Muhammad. He goes to his warrior, said, who will rid me of the chieftain? One warrior said, I will if you permit me to lie. Muhammad said, go. So he lies, goes to the chieftain, said, I've left Muhammad. He's a heretic. I want to help you, but they're after me. The chieftain says, okay, tell you what, you can spend the night in my tent. You'll have the whole army surrounding you. You'll be safe. In the middle of the night, the warrior tiptoes over and beheads the chieftain, takes his head all the way to Muhammad, said, Allah's face is shown upon you. And Muhammad said, oh, Allah's face is shown upon you. And he gives him his staff and said, you can lean on this in the day of judgment. And so Muhammad approved of lying to your enemy so you can behead him.
Mm-hmm.
And one other story, there was a warrior of Muhammad's who was captured, forced to renounce Muhammad, and he escaped, goes back, and Muhammad forgives him. And Muhammad said, if they make you turn, turn, but don't turn in your heart. In other words, it's okay to deny Muhammad in a pinch to save your skin, as long as you don't fight against Islam.
Hmm.
In other words, it's okay to say you're not a Muslim in order to get elected, but then everything you do once you're elected is to help advance Islam.
Oh, boy. That's a good place to end there, I think, Bill. You've been making a number of applications along the way, and I really appreciate that.
I would like to give the definition of peace.
Yes, please do.
In Islam, they believe that when the whole world submits to the will of Allah, there will be peace.
Mm-hmm.
So to them, world peace means world Islam.
Yeah, it's not assimilation, it's domination, right?
Right.
As they come in.
Yeah.
And so the president, when he comes out and says that Islam is a religion of peace, yeah, that could be a true statement, but you have to define what you mean by peace when you say that. William Federer, we thank you very much. Wow, what a history lesson that we got on the radio program today. I want to make sure, well, first of all, Bill, thank you for coming to the studio to talk about these things, but I want to make sure I give the listening audience your website and how they can get a copy of some of your latest books. The website, again, is called AmericanMinute.com. That's AmericanMinute.com. Go out there, find out about Bill and his books, the books that we were talking about today, specifically the book that we were talking about today was What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. You can go out there on Bill's website in order to get a copy. Let me tell you, my friend, this is vital reading, especially during our day and age. Remember this. The Lord Jesus Christ said this. He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We'll see you next time.